Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, June 3rd, 2006. Our focus today is on ending the war on Iraq. Here's what we have coming up for you. After some news, we'll have coverage of the May 31st actions at New Hampshire legislative offices, followed by an interview with Anthony Arnav, author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. In our second hour, we'll bring you Media Minutes, reporting on the flurry of proposed legislation addressing network neutrality and more, and hear from Jav Parrish about undermining the war effort. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for news. And now for some news you need to know. We begin with some local news, published in the Portsmouth Herald on June 1st. Anti-war protests target lawmakers. Local peace activists read the names of the 11 New Hampshire soldiers killed in Iraq since 2003, as well as hundreds of other U.S. soldiers and Iraqi civilians. And though their intended audience was not present, their message was clear. David Diamond of Seacoast Peace Response, standing in front of Senator Judd Gregg's office at Pease International Tradeport, said, "We're here to demand an end to the Iraq war. Not one more death, not one more dollar." The slogan is a rallying cry of New Hampshire Peace Action, which organized similar protests at all 14 congressional offices throughout the state on Wednesday. They are demanding a clear exit strategy for the war and an open debate in the House about the war. William Woodward of Durham started the day expecting to be arrested. And that's what happened a few hours later when he and five other people were charged with criminal trespassing when they refused to leave Representative Jeb Bradley's Dover office until he indicated he will work with fellow congresspeople to withdraw troops either immediately or by the end of the year. "I've exhausted the conventional approaches," said Woodward, who has marched at protests in D.C. and New York City, written letters to newspapers, and spoken with Bradley personally. "And nothing has happened. So this is a last resort effort to represent public opinion to our elected representatives," he said. Stephen Cardwell of Durham made copies of emails he sent to President Bush and Gregg in 2003, voicing his opposition to the war. "Since then," he said, "he's seen the war get out of control the way he thought it would, and it is important to let elected officials know most of the state and the country agree with him. It's sad that our government wasn't a voice for the people," said Cardwell. "I just think it's important as a citizen to speak out and let the government know how you think they're doing. That's why I'm here today." Meanwhile, across the country, the Associated Press reported on May 31st, war protesters in Olympia blasted with pepper spray again. Dozens of people protesting Iraq-bound military shipments were blasted with pepper spray, and 22 people were arrested in continuing war protests at the port of Olympia. Two people were arrested for failure to disperse and the rest for criminal trespass Tuesday night after protesters tore off a gate, entered port property, lay down, and refused to leave, Thurston County Sheriff's Captain Bradley Watkins said. Most of the arrests were made when demonstrators tore down the chain-link gate at the main port entry and confronted a line of law enforcement personnel in riot gear and helmets with face shields. As the protesters lay on the ground and linked arms, they were dragged away one by one and handcuffed as supporters yelled, "Let them go! Let them go!" During the uproar, City Council member T.J. Johnson got upset with officers who had used a baton to prod a bakery owner who had been watching as a bystander, the Olympian reported. Johnson, who stood face to face with the troopers in defiance until pepper spray was fired, told the newspaper afterward There was plenty of blame to go around for what happened, but added that he understood protesters were frustrated. He said, "They're thinking of everything they can do to stop this war, and it still continues, even through our downtown." And another story about this week's many acts of resistance. This one published on May 29th by the Spectrum of Southern Utah. "Not Here: Divine Strike Protesters Gather in Nevada." Though Divine Strike has been delayed indefinitely, more than 200 people peacefully demonstrated on Sunday to stop the planned bomb test at the Nevada test site. More than 30 were arrested when they crossed over onto the site. The Pentagon's Defense Threat Reduction Agency planned the 700-ton non-nuclear fuels explosion to test the effects of ground shock on hardened targets, but critics worry that such a large blast will disrupt radioactive particles left over from Cold War-era atomic testing there. For many at Sunday's protest, it was about more than the health consequences of the large blast. A large portion of the group comprised members of the Western Shoshone Nation and supporters who argue that the test site, along with most of Nevada and parts of California, Idaho, and Utah, is still Western Shoshone land. They say the federal government is violating the 1863 Treaty of Ruby Valley by testing weapons there. Tom Goldtooth of the Indigenous Environmental Network said part of the demonstration was to remind the U.S. government it is trespassing on the land of a sovereign state, the Western Shoshone Nation. As the large group marched up to the test site entrance, Goldtooth told the security guards why they had gathered. "Your government has contaminated this land, has abused this land, but we are here in peace." To prove their point, more than 30 demonstrators crossed over the boundary onto the site in an act of civil disobedience. Site security and Nye County, Nevada sheriff's deputies arrested those crossing the line and escorted them to a nearby holding facility. All those crossing the line had permits from the Western Shoshone Nation to be on the land and argued that the government troops and sheriff were the ones trespassing, not them. One Shoshone man said as he stepped over the line, "This is treaty land. You're in violation of the treaty. We're not breaking the law. You're the ones breaking the law." Even Carrie Dan, a Shoshone grandmother who has fought for the land much of her life, crossed the line in one of the day's more emotional events. Peggy Mays Johnson of Citizen Alert, an environmental justice organization, said it brought tears to her eyes watching Dan cross the line. "This is outrageous," Johnson said. "This is her land. It's just an outrage. How dare they?" That's all our news for today. We now bring you coverage from the May 31st anti-war protests at legislative offices across the state.
Hello, Steve Capron here reporting for Making Waves. We are at a busy crossroads in Dover, New Hampshire, and we are with the people from Seacoast Peace Response and Witness for Peace, who are protesting in front of Jeb Bradley's office. I'm in the middle of all the demonstrators, and I'm going to ask a few questions to some of the people. Hi there.
Hi.
What brings you here, and what would you like to accomplish?
It's very simple. What brings me here is the war in Iraq, and what I'd like to see accomplished is for it to be finished, for us at least, to bring American troops home alive now. The war is wrong. More Americans and Iraqis die every single day. The war is getting uglier and uglier as we see accounts of massacres and so on. And it's not the American way. America, that's not who we are. We can't afford it. We can't afford the lives that are being lost there, our own and other nations. And we certainly can't afford the billions and billions and billions of dollars that we're spending there. That's why.
We've had a recent history of a lot of unpopular military actions and wars and so forth. What do you think it is? What is missing from the American democratic system that would allow people to put a stop to this? It seems that they're operating against the will of a significant percentage of the population.
Well, you're certainly right. We have a president who tells us to our face, I don't care what the people think. I read the polls, I see the numbers, but I'm just going to go my way no matter what. We also have a constitution that says Congress is supposed to declare war. And when was the last time that happened? 1941, was it, Pearl Harbor? So Congress continually abdicates its responsibility. It's a lot easier to give it over to the man on the white horse, which is George W. Bush. And he's real happy to have that. And he's happy to pursue the war in any terms that he sees fit, which is exactly what he does. He knows 70% of America is against it. He knows he doesn't have the support of the American people. He totally ignores that. That's what's wrong with our system.
There was recent news this morning that the student loan arrangement is being changed to increase the interest rates that students have to pay on their college loans to 7%, which is much, much higher than the program originally was. And of course, the government line is we can't afford it. Why do you think the government can afford enormously expensive military actions but can't afford education?
Well, is it a matter of can't or want? It's a matter of priorities, isn't it? The people that make those decisions would rather spend the money killing people in Iraq than educating people in America. It's that simple. I think most people would say that's twisted logic, and that's bass ackwards, as we used to say.
How long have you been coming to demonstrations like this? Is this something you're doing recently or have been doing for some time?
I've been doing it for quite some time, since probably about 2003 when the war began. I went to George Bush's inauguration to demonstrate. I went to the Republican National Convention in New York City and many here locally in the Seacoast, Dover, which is where I live. Trying our best to convince the people that we've elected to make decisions for us to make the ones that we obviously want them to make, instead of pigheadedly sticking to disruptive and dangerous and immoral policies.
Has anybody from the congressman's office acknowledged you in any way or come out to talk to you, or have you been into the office?
Not since I've been here. Some of the other people were here before I have. They know we're here. They're usually very friendly about things. Of course, we're just exercising our rights as American citizens, obviously. He is our congressman, whether we like it or not. And you know, there's a window right there. They can look out and see. And we'll go in a little while after more of the people have gathered together here. And we want to read the names of the American dead, as many as we can of the Iraqi dead. And you know, the shame is we won't be able to do that because there are too many. We won't be able to finish. And we can't do it on a current basis because today there'll be more. Every day there are more. That's what's just so horrible about this. 2,500 now.
And so often we mention how many Americans were killed, but the percentage of Iraqis is enormous, and they don't seem to even be able to put a number on it.
Well, you know why? Because George W. Bush made a conscious, deliberate policy to not count the Iraqi dead. So that, what, we don't want to know, or he doesn't want us to know. Just like the military funerals and the coffins coming back, where the public is banned. We don't want you to see that. You might not like this war so much if you saw what it was really costing. You saw the dead young men and women, their coffins, their funerals, and we knew whether it was 50,000, 100,000, 200,000 Iraqis who had been killed in the meantime in the same process.
Well, that brings up another point, which is the control of the information is now much more in the hands of the government. The idea of embedded news people who are, of course, chosen, and very often the footage, the news footage, is footage that was shot by the army itself. So there's
And we found out that they now pay Iraqi journalists to run stories placed by the army or by the military. It's really incredible, actually. This is the most secretive American administration in history that in my history at least. And let's face it, no criticism if you intend it, but the American media has totally failed to do the job that should be done on covering what's really going on in this war. Of course, it's hard when the government deliberately throws up roadblocks in their way so that you can't, in many cases, find out what the true facts are. And you worry that they're looking over your shoulder, listening to your telephone calls and so on as well. So, it's tough.
Do you think that the whole business of the anti-terrorism campaign, where they do listen in on phone calls and so forth, do you think that's going to become a permanent part of the American experience?
Wow, I sure hope not. I mean, we got rid of it when during the Joe McCarthy era. You know, we veered off that way and then came back to our senses. I certainly hope this isn't a permanent part of the American public and political landscape.
Well, there was a recent program on public television celebrating the experience of Edward R. Murrow in London. One of the things he's known for saying was that the British went all the way through World War II without dismantling any element of their democracy. That throughout the whole war, they continued to have a free and open society, excepting, of course, military secrets. But
yeah, well, history should teach us something, shouldn't it? Yeah. And unfortunately, right now, today, too many Americans are willing, you know what they say, anyone who's willing to trade their liberty for a little security doesn't deserve either one. And I'm starting to think maybe that's true. We don't need to give up our rights in order to have a little more, quote, security. Do we have any more anyway? Who knows? And was there ever a threat to it in the first place? You know, was Saddam Hussein somehow a threat to the United States? I don't think so.
Well, thank you very much for taking a little bit of time to talk to us.
Thank you.
We are in Dover, and we are at the office of Congressman Jeb Bradley. And there is a group of people here demonstrating against the war from a number of organizations. I see signs from Veterans for Peace, Witness for Peace, a number of different Seacoast Peace Response, lots of different people. And even as we speak, there are two other reporters. So the event is, three other reporters. So the event is clearly very successful in drawing attention and raising questions about the whole business of our involvement in Iraq. We're occasionally competing, as we are now, with the internal combustion engine. I'm going to go up and see if I can interview somebody else. Hi, would you mind if I asked you a couple of questions?
No, not at all.
All right. We're speaking now to another person who's here demonstrating. She has a sign that says, "Not one more death." Have you done this before?
I have done this before, not in front of Senator Bradley's office, but yes, I have before.
Are you involved with any particular organization or just here as an individual? Or?
Well, I am involved with the Dover Friends meeting, and I am becoming involved with Seacoast Peace Response.
What do you think this sort of thing does? Is it a way to get attention to the whole question of the war in Iraq, or do you think it has any influence on the congresspeople themselves? Or?
Well, I would hope it would have some influence on Congressman Bradley, but I can't vouch for that. I mean, I think it raises awareness that there are people out there who believe that this war is wrong and are willing to stand up and say so. And I believe a lot of the people who are passing us by have the same belief, but are a little hesitant to go out on the street and make it known. So I think somebody has to do that.
Sure, I've noticed that as cars go by, some people toot their horn or wave or whatever, but apparently not to the point of coming here and standing beside you.
Right, right.
Do you think that the war will just proceed if you are not successful in convincing George Bush to put an end to this? Do you see this war going on and on and on for years, or do you think it'll end in a shorter time?
I think until the oil is gone, we're there. At least as far as as far as the corporations go, if they can continue to get the oil from Iraq and cheaply, they will, on the backs of the U.S. taxpayers, they'll do it.
So you feel that it's an energy war?
Yes, I think it's a war for corporations.
We have had almost no activity in finding alternative sources of energy and developing them under the Bush administration. Do you think that there is a promise in this sort of thing, in reducing our dependence on petroleum?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know some people in this group own hybrid cars, and I think there, you know, I know a guy who's a member of the Dover Friends meeting who's working on a biodiesel project. There's certainly lots of opportunities out there if we want to address them. But time is getting shorter and shorter. We've got to do it.
When they first began the occupation, they were talking about supporting the occupation of Iraq with the enormous oil reserves of the country, but that has not turned out to be the case. We are supporting it through American tax money.
Yes, that's right. Every penny is coming from the American tax budget, and you can see the pressure on elderly health care costs, the pressure on our infrastructure, the pressure on, you know, every program that we have in this country for education, poverty, environment. It's all going to the war. I mean, $300+ billion in the war. And that's all money that could be used to provide services here.
Why is it that these people are so drawn to the military solution of problems? They seem to advance it as the first thing that they think of. And it seems strange in a democratic country with the...
Well, I mean, it's all about power and control, isn't it? And, I mean, I have a pen from Priorities New Hampshire, which shows the U.S. military budget and shows the military budgets of other countries. It's insane. Literally, our military budget is equal to that of all other countries combined. Why? Military contractors give a lot of money to candidates. A lot!
The military-industrial complex that Eisenhower spoke of when he left office, this gathering of interest in maintaining a big military presence?
Right, exactly. Exactly. The military-industrial complex is so powerful and so huge and touches so many people's lives that people are afraid to cut the military budget for fear their uncle or their cousin or their brother will be laid off. It's not because people don't believe that there are peaceful solutions possible. I think people are afraid of losing their jobs.
What happened over at Pease?
Well, we read the names of the fallen, both Iraqis and Americans, at Judd Gregg's office and Sununu's office, two senators. But because the Representative Bradley is up for election, we decided to focus more hours here and to follow it at 5 o'clock with sit-in, civil disobedience.
Now, the civil disobedience is going to take place here. And the thinking is that because Bradley is up for re-election, being a congressman as opposed to a senator, that it'll be this is the place to go.
Well, this is an opportunity for the public who agree with us to see that this man's still supporting the war, or to see that he's responded. We thank him for his town meetings, meeting at least twice with this very group, Seacoast Peace Response. We thank him for that. He listens. But his voting record shows that he's firmly supporting the war agenda.
Alrighty. Well, thank you. I have been deliberately not asking people to give me names because people are very hesitant to do so now. A number of news stories that I have reported having to do with environmental issues and so forth, people have not been interested in giving me names, so I have just not asked people their names. If you would like, I can you can identify yourself on the air, but many people prefer not to.
No, I'm Bill Woodward, professor at UNH.
Oh, sure.
I'm one of the people who's going to do the civil disobedience. We have a letter to Bradley, which I could share with you, which identifies our issues and the survey data that suggests that the people of New Hampshire support our position. They are increasingly, the majority is now asking us to get out of Iraq.
Now, is that a copy that I can take?
Definitely.
Terrific. Okay, yep. We have a letter to Congressman Jeb Bradley from Seacoast Peace Response, and we will incorporate this into our report. And this is Steve Capron in Dover, New Hampshire, for Making Waves, WSCA, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is the letter from Seacoast Peace Response to Congressman Jeb Bradley. Dear Congressman Bradley, we have met with you twice to discuss the war in Iraq. New Hampshire voters find the human and financial costs of this war unacceptable, and they find your support of this war unacceptable. We are writing to demand that you act in Congress to terminate this war by the end of this year. We remind you of this war's human costs. More than 2,400 U.S. soldiers killed, more than 17,000 seriously wounded, and an estimated 100,000 Iraqi civilians killed. The loss of our nation's prestige in the world community is incalculable. On May 31st, we visit your Dover office to honor these lives. The cost of this war is now estimated to be $1 trillion. We urge you to vote against the next spending bill on this unbearably expensive war. We want you to reject budget requests for the war and to reject further increases in the debt ceiling. We further request that you make a more serious effort to stop the killing by removing a key reason for the violence. Four separate polls, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Newsweek, conducted in early May, showed Americans disapprove of Bush's handling of the war by about a 2-to-1 margin. 67% of New Hampshire citizens also disapprove of the way the president is handling Iraq, and 68% disapprove of the way he is managing foreign affairs. A majority of New Hampshire residents with an opinion on the matter are opposed to the war. To further support our demand, we direct your attention to the New York Times editorial on May 28th. Mr. Bush's premise that American troops should simply stay on the ground until Iraq gets things right and defeats all insurgent forces and terrorist groups, however long it takes, is flat wrong. The United States' presence is dangerous to the soldiers themselves, to American standing in the world, and most tellingly to large numbers of innocent Iraqis. You were elected to represent the people of New Hampshire. We represent the majority who reject President Bush and his agenda in Iraq. Your job is to represent us. We strongly urge you to change your position, to follow your electorate and not our discredited President. Some of us will remain in your office until you indicate to us that you will work for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, either immediately or at least by the end of this calendar year.
Thanks to Steve Capron from Making Waves for that report on the statewide action to end the Iraq War. Following his visit to the scene, over 50 activists from Seacoast Peace Response spent the day demonstrating at Congressman Bradley's office in Dover. They also visited Senator Gregg's in Newington and Senator Sununu's office in Portsmouth. The action included a civil disobedience sit-in at Congressman Bradley's office in Dover, with six protesters being arrested. They were Aaron Kareen, 39 of Dover, Nina Jordan, 67 of Lee, Randy Kezar, 69 of Kingston, Macy Morse, 85 of Portsmouth, Lee Roberts, 70 from Portsmouth, and William Woodward, 61 of Durham. Now for an interview from Mind Over Matters on Iraq, the Logic of Withdrawal.
We are talking today with Anthony Arnov. Anthony Arnov is a freelance editor, writer, and activist based in Brooklyn. He worked for 7 years as an editor and publisher with South End Press. He is currently on the editorial board of Haymarket Books. His writings have appeared in the Financial Times, The Nation, Mother Jones, Left Business Observer, In These Times, and Z Magazine. He is the co-author, along with Howard Zinn, of the book Voices of a People's History of the United States, and he is here to talk about his new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal?
Well, I was inspired by a book that the historian Howard Zinn wrote in 1967 called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. And when I was at Southend Press, the publishing house you mentioned, I had the opportunity to republish that book, which had gone out of print. It was originally published by Beacon Press and had a significant impact on the anti-war movement when it came out, in terms of making an argument at that time that the only solution to the crisis in Vietnam was immediate withdrawal, which was a minority position but eventually became the position of the anti-war movement as a whole. And unfortunately, the war continued with tragic consequences for many years after Howard's very compelling and very prescient argument that the U.S. had to get out of Vietnam. And I republished that book in the year 2002, and then when the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, I kept being struck by how many of the arguments Howard was making applied to the situation in Iraq, and really felt an urgency of providing a bit of a historical perspective about what was happening in Iraq. But also, I found myself in interesting situations where people I was speaking to who had opposed the invasion began to feel that, well, it was wrong to go into Iraq, but now that the United States is there, they can't pull out. Somehow this occupation, which is causing so much harm and suffering, has to become something that will rebuild Iraq or provide stability or security or democracy there. And really, I felt those arguments rested on some very poor assumptions and a lack of historical perspective. And I wanted to follow the model of what Howard did during the Vietnam War to make the case that immediate withdrawal really was the only logical solution to the crisis in Iraq.
In some ways, it's intriguing because I don't think there was like a lot of logic that got us in there in the first place. Maybe you could...
Definitely not.
...could go over some of the reasons.
Sure. First of all, when I say the logic of withdrawal, I'm not appealing to George Bush or the Congress. I don't think they're going to see the logic. I think it's about ordinary people seeing the logic and putting pressure on their elected leaders to pull out. So the logic, I think, is a logic that I hope that the large majority of people who now oppose this war are beginning to see and that they'll act on. But in terms of why the United States went into Iraq, it had nothing to do with the stated reasons. The stated reasons were weapons of mass destruction. Iraq was repeatedly invoked in connection with Al-Qaeda and with the attacks of 9/11. Iraq was described as this dangerous threat to U.S. interests, in fact, an imminent threat to the United States. And the idea was that by invading Iraq, the United States was preventing a terrorist attack, making the world safer, stopping weapons of mass destruction. The reality is the United States intervened in Iraq for completely different reasons. All of those arguments that they used have fallen apart. There are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, no connection to Al-Qaeda. It's now even increasingly coming out that people in the CIA and other intelligence agencies were saying that the evidence for the war was bogus. Those people were silenced, marginalized, punished, driven out of office in some cases. But the real reasons have to do with oil and geography. The fact is Iraq has the world's second largest oil reserves. It sits in a region with two-thirds of world oil reserves, and it sits in a region with increasingly important natural gas reserves. So the United States saw an opportunity after 9/11 to advance a series of objectives that it had long before 9/11 that have nothing to do with stopping terrorism but have to do with asserting American control over the energy resources of the Middle East and using that control to project power globally. And they saw an opportunity to describe that offensive project in defensive terms after 9/11. And the other thing, of course, that's important is the United States wants to have military bases in the Middle East. They've lost their military bases in Saudi Arabia, and they saw an opportunity by overthrowing the government of Iraq, not only of getting greater control over the energy resources of that region, but of establishing a firm military presence there that could be used for greater projection of power in the region.
You mentioned earlier a historical perspective. Maybe you can give us a little bit of that now. That seems that in the corporate media, when they're talking about Iraq, They seem to forget everything that happened prior to the last U.S. invasion in 91.
Well, even if they go back to that, I mean, most of the history begins in 2003. But, you know, we do need to go back. First of all, we need to go back to the 12-plus years that Iraq was subjected to sanctions. The sanctions were done in the name of the United Nations, but it was really the United States and United Kingdom who were the main backers of those sanctions. During those 12 years, the United States and United Kingdom were also periodically bombing Iraq. And as the Downing Street memos reveal, there was a plan to sharply escalate the bombing of Iraq in the year leading up to the invasion. So really, the attack on Iraq began not in March 2003, but a year before that, with attacks that certainly violated international law. They were hoping to provoke Iraq into attacking a U.S. target and then using that as the pretext for war. It didn't happen, so then they had to come up with other pretexts. But the sanctions had a devastating impact on Iraq, and they also created a hostility and a resentment of the Iraqi people, a suspicion of the Iraqi people towards claims of the United States to be liberators. The Shia population of Iraq recall that in 1991, President George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush's papa, encouraged them to rise up against Saddam Hussein. They did, and they were then allowed to be slaughtered. The United States just stood to the side and let Saddam Hussein crush the rebellion because they preferred a stable, strong man in Iraq to the alternative, which they didn't necessarily control. They didn't have another strong man to put in his place. Before that, the United States was an ally of Saddam Hussein. That's a very important fact to recall. Many of the crimes that the Iraqi government committed that were used to justify the invasion of Iraq were committed with the support and backing of the United States, using weapons supplied by U.S. companies or the U.S. military directly. Donald Rumsfeld met with Saddam Hussein, shook his hand. A number of U.S. politicians did the same. He was an ally, and in fact, Saddam Hussein would never have risen to power through the Ba'ath Party power structure, and the Ba'ath Party itself would not necessarily have risen to power if it hadn't been for support from the United States, which saw the Ba'ath Party as a bulwark against communism. There was a strong secular communist party in Iraq. The Ba'ath Party slaughtered 5,000 members of that party and allies, trade unionists, women, women's group leaders, and so on, using lists supplied by the CIA. And the U.S. has a long history there, and it's not just there, but in the Middle East, not of supporting democracy, but of supporting repressive regimes and discouraging the growth of democracy in the region, because democratic movements in that region tend to have a nationalist character and tend to demand things like nationalization of oil, which is quite contrary to the interests of the United States.
So then we move forward to the U.S. invasion and occupation, and that is turning out quite different than expected by the administration.
Absolutely. Remember, there's a whole series of claims that were made. This would be a quick occupation. The Iraqis would greet us as liberators. They would greet us with sweets and flowers, in the word of one Iraqi exile who was very influential in the build-up for the scenario of the invasion. They said that the occupation would pay for itself because Iraqi oil would start flowing immediately. The Iraqis would stop fighting on behalf of the Iraqi government, but would turn sides and fight alongside the United States against the Iraqi government, and that Iraq would become a beacon of democracy in the Middle East as part of this wave of democratization in the region. And, you know, none of those things has borne out, and in fact, the anti-war movement predicted ahead of time that none of those things would happen. We predicted that the Iraqis would see us as occupiers, not as liberators, which is what has happened. We predicted that the war would be costly, both in terms of the economic cost of this war, but also in terms of the loss of human life that it would bring about. And the occupation is now 3 years old, and every day it gets worse. The violence increases. The situation for ordinary Iraqis is miserable. They have less electricity, less access to safe drinking water. Unemployment has skyrocketed. People are afraid to send their children to school. People are afraid to leave their homes. Violence has increased drastically, and the United States has fueled sectarian divisions in that country, and it has emboldened quite reactionary fundamentalist forces that gained legitimacy partly because of the sanctions, which created such misery in the country that it encouraged a turn towards Islamism in a very secular, advanced, modern country, but also because those groups have been able to use opposition to the occupation as a rallying call and an organizing principle. So the occupation, rather than lessening the likelihood of civil war, has greatly increased it.
Talk about the reasons for why you see we need immediate withdrawal. If you listen to the opposition party in the U.S., which currently is the Democrats, they seem pretty unanimous in that we can't cut and run. We have to hang in there until whatever is achieved.
I think it's not really accurate to call the Democrats an opposition party. They're not even really a loyal opposition. They're engaged in a tactical debate with the Republicans over how best to occupy Iraq. But the reality is there's no good way to occupy another country. Hillary Clinton, Joe Lieberman calling for more troops to be sent into Iraq, as if that's the problem. We don't have enough troops there. The reality is the troops are causing the resistance. The troops are creating instability. The troops are contributing to a situation in which there's not a legitimate Iraqi government. The people see those people who are in the process of forming a government in Iraq, and they see that those people are accountable to and dependent on the United States, that they're making deals with the United States about long-term military bases, that they're making deals with the United States about oil in contradiction to the interests of the Iraqi people. They don't want the Iraqi military to be a tool of the United States. They don't want military bases, and they don't want the oil of the country going to benefit the West rather than benefiting Iraqis. So the situation is tremendously unstable, and the reality is the longer the U.S. stays, the worse it's going to get. We've been told over and over and over again, we've turned a corner. Remember, you know, we said, well, once we capture Saddam Hussein, then things will get better in Iraq. And then they captured Saddam Hussein, and then that didn't make things better. And then they said, well, once we get rid of Ba'ath Party influence in the government, that will take care of things, and that didn't do it. And then they said, okay, well, look, we don't want to have elections, but we've been pressured into having elections. Once we have those elections, things will get better. And things continued to decline after the elections. And they said, well, once a stable government forms, all these benchmarks that they've created, none of them have led to an improvement of the situation. And the reality is the occupation distorts every aspect of Iraqi society. And until we remove the occupation, that will continue to be the case. And it will continue to be the case that these sectarian conflicts will be fueled by the arms of the United States. And the United States has been arming Shia militias, and it's been using classic colonial divide and rule strategies. And as long as they're there, they'll continue to do that.
So maybe you can address a couple of the reasons that you'll hear in the media for staying there, even though you just gave a good overall picture. For instance, the idea of we just have to hang in there a little longer to bring democracy to the country.
Sure. Yeah, this is the new lie. You know, the first big lie of this war was weapons of mass destruction. The new big lie is democracy. Well, look, if we believed in democracy, then why don't we ask the Iraqi people what they want? The Iraqi people have said overwhelmingly, it's in polling, it's been established through a number of polls, including polls done by the British government and the U.S. government, that the Iraqi people don't welcome the U.S. occupation. They oppose it. The Iraqi people also support attacks on the U.S. occupation, even if those are violent attacks. So they object to the occupation. They want to have a say in the formation of their own government without foreign interference. The other thing that the Iraqi people say is that they would like the oil resources of the country to go for Iraqi development in a kind of federalized structure rather than what the United States has put in place through the Constitution that they drafted, which is a radically federalized structure in which the oil resources are distributed unevenly. Oil in Iraq is concentrated in the north and the predominantly Kurdish region, and in the south in the predominantly Shia region. And through that federalized structure, the Sunni, who are predominantly concentrated in the center of the country where there aren't concentrations of oil, face the prospect of a future without that kind of economic resource, without job opportunities, without economic development. It's a recipe for civil war. And so the reality is that this occupation is the negation of democracy. Occupations always are about imposing the will of a foreign power on another power. That's the opposite of democracy.
Well, you mentioned civil war. Many people are saying if we pull out now, the country will erupt into civil war.
Well, the reality is the country may erupt into civil war when the United States pulls out because of what we've set into motion. I think that the chances of civil war increase greatly the longer the United States stays, rather than decreasing. The Constitution defines political power in terms of sectarian divisions. The United States has armed Shia militias that have been carrying out attacks on Sunnis, often using the cover of the Interior Ministry, the government, the legitimate military posts to carry out these attacks. The United States has also brought into Iraq, into positions of power, the Dawah Party, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, parties that are defined in highly sectarian terms and that are undermining secular, undermining democratic possibilities in Iraq. And so if we want to lessen the possibility of civil war, one, we've got to remove the completely distorting presence of the United States. And then two, we have to take away all of the resolutions and laws that were imposed by the United States that have so federalized power in Iraq and that have defined power in these sectarian ways.
What about those that say we can't, and there's variations on this, we can't cut and run, it will only show a weak stance from the United States and encourage further terrorist attacks?
Well, the reality is the United States is encouraging terrorism by its presence in Iraq. The United States has fueled tremendous anger and resentment, not only in Iraq, but around the world. Al-Qaeda of Iraq did not exist before the U.S. intervention there. It does now. Growth of recruitment for groups like Al-Qaeda has been significant in recent years because they can point to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. They can point to Abu Ghraib, the images of torture and abuse. They can point to the fact that the United States seems to many people around the world to be engaged in a war on Islam. And that has fueled the kind of anger and resentment and hostility and frustration that leads people not only to join those kinds of organizations, but to want to target the United States and its allies. Madrid and London were both targeted for terrorist attacks because of their alliance with the United States in invading Iraq. So the United States is not lessening the threat of terrorism. It's fueling the threat of terrorism by being in Iraq. The sooner it gets out, the sooner it can begin to change course, not just in Iraq, but more globally. The U.S. is a target because of its invasion of Iraq, but also because of its support for Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands and its support for a series of repressive regimes in the Middle East and in Asia and elsewhere as well that have repressed their populations, denied democracy to their populations. That's what makes us vulnerable, not because people hate our freedoms or they hate democracy.
Another of the we can't cut and run options is we can't do so because it will dishonor the sacrifice of the soldiers who have already died there.
Yeah, this is George Bush's common refrain. We have to honor the sacrifice of those who died by continuing the mission that they died for. Well, first of all, the soldiers may have had many motivations for going into Iraq. I suspect that they had to do with the stated reasons that we were somehow stopping a horrible dictator with weapons of mass destruction who was a threat to the United States, that we were bringing democracy, that we were freeing people from oppression. But many soldiers have now concluded the opposite. That's not what they were doing. 72% of soldiers in a recent Zoghbi poll said that they want to get out of Iraq. Groups like Iraq Veterans Against War have formed. Soldiers are speaking out. Pablo Paredes, Camilo Mejia, a number of people declaring conscientious objection, saying, I'm not going to fight and die for oil. I'm not going to fight and die for empire. And the reality is, these people have died needlessly. The 2,400 U.S. soldiers have died needlessly. All of the Iraqis that have died needlessly. And to compound those deaths is only to compound the tragedy. To have one more person die for a lie is only to compound the tragedy of those who have already sacrificed their lives for this unjust and illegal war.
And one final reason for why we need to stay there that I don't actually hear from the administration, but I actually read fairly regularly in letters to the editor, is that we need to stay there and fight them on their turf, or we'll be fighting them here in the United States.
Absolutely. This is a thing you hear often. Fight them over there, kill them there, rather than risk the idea that they might come and attack us here in the United States. What this rests on, again, is a connection between Iraq and 9/11. There was no connection between Iraq and 9/11. It was a false claim that was used to sell war to a skeptical public and to manipulate people's fear and anxiety and anger over 9/11. We are creating more terrorists in Iraq. We're fueling recruitment, as I suggested, for terrorist organizations. But we're also using terrorism against the Iraqi people. The siege of Fallujah involved seizing Fallujah General Hospital. That was the first action of that intervention. We're engaged in war crimes in Iraq. This idea that the United States stops terrorism by violating the Geneva Conventions, violating international law, invading other countries, is completely illusory. The United States is only making the world more dangerous, and in fact is also making the world more dangerous in another important way, which is to fuel the development of nuclear weapons around the world. Because people look at the United States invasion of Iraq and they see that the U.S. invaded Iraq not because it had weapons of mass destruction, but because it did not. They didn't have a deterrent to U.S. power. And so countries around the world are racing to develop that deterrent, and that certainly explains the situation with regard to what's happening now in Iran. And the escalating rhetoric around Iran is very worse indeed. You go back to the Vietnam War. The war in Vietnam was decisively over by 1968 in terms of the ability of the United States to impose its will on the Vietnamese people. The Tet Offensive proved decisively that the United States had lost the war, but the conflict continued and expanded into Laos and Cambodia, and we have to take very seriously the threat that this administration would expand the war into Iran.
All right, so I believe you stated early on that you didn't expect our elected officials to take the lead on this. What do you see needs to happen?
Well, I see a number of people taking a lead around the issue of Iraq. I mentioned Camilo Mejia and Pablo Paredes. It's very important that soldiers themselves are speaking out or organizing. If you go back to the Vietnam War, that was a crucial element to ending that war. There was a rebellion within the ranks of the U.S. military. People don't know that history, but it's very eloquently described in a new film called Sir, No Sir, which has just been released, that documents that rebellion, and in a book called Soldiers in Revolt by David Courtwright with a new introduction by Howard Zinn. So I'm very encouraged by those people who are organizing within the ranks of the military to oppose this war. I'm also really encouraged by the military families. A while ago in Seattle, Cindy Sheehan spoke. Cindy Sheehan has provided tremendous courage and leadership to the anti-war movement. She lost her son, Casey, on April 4th, 2004, in Iraq, and she has spoken out ever since. Specifically, has very effectively countered that idea that there was a noble cause that her son died for, and that we have to continue that mission to honor her son's sacrifice. And she and others have formed Gold Star Families for Peace, military families organizations that are also organizing very effectively against the war. Then on campuses and in communities around the country, there's been a burgeoning counter-recruitment movement challenging the lies that the military tells to get people into the military. Military recruitment is down significantly. They have not had such a hard time getting people to join the military since just after the Vietnam War. And particularly, they've had a sharp decline in African American and Latino recruitment, which I think is significant. People are understanding the racist character of this war and the connection between the war abroad and a war at home and working and poor people. There's also groups forming among trade unions, like U.S. Labor Against War, New York Labor Against War. This is happening much earlier than happened during the Vietnam War. And all of these grassroots efforts come together. In Wisconsin, 24 communities passed Out Now resolutions. In Seattle, there's a proposition, Proposition 86, to challenge recruitment in public schools and parks. The Seattle Parent Teacher Association at Garfield High School passed a resolution against recruitment. San Francisco passed counter recruitment initiatives. These things can come together and provide the kind of bottom-up leadership that can force pressure politicians to do something that right now they seem completely unwilling to contemplate, which is get out of Iraq and stop squandering so much money on this war, money that could be far better spent on education, healthcare in this country, veterans programs in this country, which have been badly cut, and ultimately also on reparations to the Iraqi people, who certainly deserve reparations after all the harm and suffering we've caused them.
Then, beyond just this current war in Iraq, do you see a bigger picture that needs to be addressed here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think Iraq is a symptom. It's a symptom of a drive for empire, which expresses itself in a number of ways. It expresses itself in the possibility of war with Iran. It expresses itself in U.S. intervention in Latin America, most recently with the U.S. effort to support a coup attempt in Venezuela. And it connects itself to the fact that the U.S., in order to maintain this global empire, is spending hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, really, to maintain military bases in some 170 countries around the world. And this is fueling globally resentment and anger, but it's also taking an enormous toll at home. The war abroad is connected with a war on civil liberties in this country that is quite alarming. The government has asserted a whole series of privileges of executive power to wiretap, to survey, to infiltrate peaceful organizations, to investigate without warrant, to wiretap without warrant, and we should be very concerned about that. It's also connected with a lowering down of the standards of torture globally. The United States has basically asserted a right to torture, a right to engage in cruel and inhumane treatment. And the United States has also expanded this doctrine of preemptive war. But there's a contradiction. The United States is saying it alone can use these policies. It alone can use this doctrine. Well, the world doesn't work that way. Israel has asserted the right. Russia has asserted the right. China has asserted the right to use preemptive strikes. Pakistan and India, two nuclear powers, have also asserted that right. So we're setting in place an escalation of the likelihood of war, an escalation of the likelihood of nuclear war. And once you start talking about that, you really start talking about whether or not the species will survive. I think that the path that Washington has set us down, it's not just the Republicans, it's the Democrats and the Republicans, is leading towards a completely unsustainable future. So it's in Iraq, we have to not only get out of Iraq, but I think we have to make that part of a reversal of course. You know, you go back to Martin Luther King, when he spoke out against the Vietnam War, he said in his Riverside Church speech of April 4, 1967, "You can't separate war from racism, you can't separate war from economic exploitation. These are the triple evils we confront." And he was getting at the root of war, and a drive for dominating other resources, dominating other people, dominating other markets, controlling other people, and the racism that's necessary to do that. And unless we start really addressing those triple evils that Martin Luther King talked about, I think really we're down a path where we don't have much time left to reverse course, where we're going to have less and less time to push towards a more sustainable way of supplying our energy needs, push towards a more sustainable way of meeting our needs as a society, and certainly a more sustainable way of dealing with conflict in our world.
I'd like to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Just been talking with Anthony Arnov. He is author of the new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. And again, you can find out more information about the tour at the website endthewartour.org.
Thanks to Mind Over Matters for that interview with Anthony Arnov. You're listening to Making Waves.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.